Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. You're listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. This is part two of our chat with Phillips Payson O'Brien, whose sensational book, How the War Was Won, has got us, well, I mean, it's blown my mind. You talk in the book a lot about the strategic bombing of Japanese cities and Tokyo and what a shock it is initially, and then the Japanese adapt to it. And even because the population's so mobilized, even though hundreds of thousands of people are killed in this area bombing, that actually where you put it on the ledger of how effectively it's attacking the Japanese economy, because mining, after all, is the thing that the Air Force don't want to do, because there's no sort of props in it, is there? There's no glamour in mining. It's not glamorous, but it's incredibly effective if what you're talking about is maximum effect for your effort. But when you talk about the war in the Far East, you end up having, we end up on the atom bomb, is that strategic bombing of the cities isn't having the effect it's appearing to have. But then, of course, suddenly you get the two atom bombs and the moment changes. And it's the eternal question, isn't it? Because there are two sides of the atom bomb debate. The people say it's unnecessary because it's wantonly cruel. And then the people who say, well, absolutely, there was absolutely no choice. And the Americans did the right thing. Where do you sit in?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, part of I've been influenced because I've just written a biography of Admiral William Leahy. He's the President's Chief of Staff and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Yeah.
And he has an extraordinary position. He's the most senior American military officer at that point in the war, first five-star officer. And yet he's the most violently opposed to the atom bomb. But he's also opposed to the invasion of Japan. And it is an interesting, what Leahy said is, look, we have won the war. It's summer of 1945. Yeah. War's over. Japan is cut off from the sea. It can't live. It cannot fight. So Japan will have to surrender. Now, we have two options, or three options. The first option is to use the atom bomb if that works. We should not use it. And I have to say, the most effective argument he uses, and I think this is one the backers have to deal with, is this weapon is worse than poison gas, and we wouldn't use poison gas, so why would we use it? We could have dropped poison gas on Japanese cities, German cities, at any point in the war. That was considered a more horrible weapon. Yet here we are using something, and by the way, they thought could poison the soil for 1,000 years. You know, they didn't actually know how long-lasting the impact of the radiation would be. And you know, Leahy's argument is, if we don't use poison gas, then how can we use this? Someone explained to me why this is morally superior when it is a poisonous weapon.
That's a very powerful initial point, isn't it? I mean, that's one that when you read, because this is a debate that ends up in newspapers and all over. When you read, you never see that really put into the picture, do you? I mean, right. So that's his first thing. The other two options are
we can invade, but no, we shouldn't invade because that will be very bloody. We've just seen
for everybody.
So you just let them stew in their own mire of economic.
Basically, the war will go on for longer, maybe another 6 months. He doesn't really think it'll go on for that much longer, but you know, it'll be 3 months, 6 months, at most 9 months. Many Japanese might die. There could be starvation, but Japan is doomed. And you know, why invade? They want us to invade. The Japanese want the United States to invade to have a really bloody battle as their last chance to get good terms. You don't invade. You don't drop the atom bomb. You just wait and starve them out. And so that's his option.
I've got to say, I find that an incredibly convincing
argument. Well, I mean, more Japanese might have died. That's the fascinating moral thing. If you're talking about numbers of death, under Leahy's way, very few Americans would have died. But many Japanese more might have died than died in the atom bomb. So if you're talking about, if you have mass famine throughout, Japan is a heavily populated island. I think sometimes people don't realize how many people there are in Japan. I think there's about 80 million people in Japan in the second, which is the size of Britain. Huge population in a relatively small area. If famine takes control, you could have a million people die quite quickly. So under Leahy's system, there might have been more deaths than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So if you believe Japanese deaths are the key thing, the atom bomb might save them. But he said it's simply not worth it for us to drop the first atom bomb. He believes very much in an ethical message. Mm. The great message we can send to the world is we have developed this and we chose not to use it. It's so horrible, we choose not to use it.
Dear God.
But Truman simply can't. Truman doesn't have that kind of moral qualm. And Truman wants to end the war as soon as possible. His view is if we've developed this weapon, if they find out we developed this weapon and I didn't use it and the war went on for six more months, every American who died, their parents will hate me and that this will end up being devastating to me. So if we have the weapon, we have to use it. And Leahy said even Roosevelt, Leahy was really close to Roosevelt. He's one of Roosevelt's oldest friends. And he was trying to convince Roosevelt not to use the weapon, but he was like, if push came to shove, Roosevelt probably might very well have used it as well.
You should tell us a bit more about Leahy, though, because he's such an interesting character and he's had such a fascinating career. And yet he is a kind of forgotten man of World War II, isn't he? Despite the enormity of his position.
Absolutely. He's one of those. It's a bit like that moment where when I was a graduate student and I found that statistic that made no sense. When I started writing how the war was won, and I was really interested in the application of grand strategy and how the Western allies decided where to send their air and sea power, I started looking at the structure of decision making. And most people here, Alan Brooke or George Marshall, and in the American terms, Marshall is the senior person. But actually, if you look at the chain of command, Marshall, and by the way, I was told this by a librarian at the Marshall Library down in Lexington, Virginia. He said Marshall probably saw Roosevelt alone fewer than five times in the war. Probably saw him alone fewer than five. Basically, Roosevelt didn't like Marshall. He found Marshall to be very stiff. They didn't get along. He never invited Marshall to Hyde Park.
Wow.
Marshall, in fact, the only time he was invited to Hyde Park was Roosevelt's funeral. He wanted an invitation.
What?
He never got it. So this idea that Marshall was somehow guiding the American strategy seemed odd when you look at the Roosevelt-Marshall relationship. And then you look at the chain of command, and actually Marshall's below Leahy. There's this guy called William Leahy who is... Roosevelt makes him a five-star the day before Marshall, so Marshall must salute him. Leahy is the first five-star, but he's the president's chief of staff. A special role is created for him, and he's the first chairman of the Joint Chiefs. This is an extraordinarily powerful position. He's chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the president's chief of staff, and the more you boil down to it, he's also Roosevelt's friend from 1913. So they have such a close relationship that actually Leahy doesn't have to write a lot down. Marshall has to write these memoranda because he can't get to Roosevelt. Leahy sees Roosevelt every day. He provides him his morning briefing. He goes with him on every trip. They spend hundreds of days together. They watch movies together in the evening.
Wow. I mean, I just hadn't appreciated that at all.
Well, that's partly Leahy's nature.
I've got Leahy's book.
So boring. It's such a... Basically, Leahy is he's a boring writer, and he writes the dullest, longest diary. I mean, the diary has been useful for me because it's so long and boring, no one else used it, really. I read the darn thing, 5,000 pages. 99% of it is boring, but then there's just pieces of gold, a few pieces of gold scattered throughout it.
So when you're doing his biography, where are you getting all the
again,
material?
The other thing, because there's never been a Leahy library, like a Marshall library, it's spread around, but he has... And I'll let anyone who wants to do it. No. He's got three collections of papers, and they're his presidential papers as chief of staff are in the Navy Yard in Washington. They're great, but they're not in the Library of Congress and they're not in the National Archives, so people don't often go to the Navy Yard. But those ended up being mostly, I would say, his papers from his period of chief of staff. His diary is in the Library of Congress in the manuscripts division, so that's separate. His papers as chairman of the Joint Chiefs were, I think, basically lost in the National Archives till I did that diary. The National Archives in America is the worst organized major archive in the world. And I say that, as an American.
Oh, God, don't even go there, Phil. It's a nightmare.
And that helped because there had been basically these chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff files, which I had to go through about six binders to find them, and no one had ever used them before. I don't think anyone had ever used them. And they're Leahy's sort of personal collection.
They came out of
his Pentagon office and they ended up in the National Archives. And then his personal papers, like his letters, ended up in the Wisconsin Historical Society. So that's why no one's really been able to do any research on him. Is it they're all over.
Because they're all over the place.
So how has this happened? Is Marshall just better at this post-war spin?
The big thing is Truman loves Marshall. I mean, if you look at the time Roosevelt dies, and this is my favorite, and by the way, I get a lot of angry emails from both Eastern Fronters and Marshall fans. Those are the people. Name me one fight that George Marshall wins in the Second World War. I can't think of one. He doesn't want to do torch in 1942. He wants a large army. He wants to invade France in 42, 43. Yep. I can't think of a single fight George Marshall wins. Basically, the United States, as long as Roosevelt is alive, Marshall loses. He loses every major fight when it comes to strategy of the Second World War. And I try to ask Marshall, name me one major fight over strategy Marshall wins. By the way, Leahy wins all of those. Leahy wants torch. He sports torch in 1941 when he's an ambassador to Vichy France. He writes to Roosevelt, says, let's invade North Africa. Leahy doesn't want to invade France in 42, 43. He basically destroys Marshall's position internally, and Leahy wants a small army. So Leahy wins all those fights. But when Truman becomes president, Truman loves Marshall. Basically, Truman's an army guy. I mean, that's a fundamental ideological thing. He's a former colonel.
He loves
colonel, isn't
Marshall.
He? So, yeah. And he basically makes Marshall, he gives Marshall every important job he can. He makes him first the special emissary to China, then he makes him Secretary of State, and then Secretary of Defense. And then Eisenhower becomes president, who loves Marshall. And when Marshall dies, they basically create this hagiography around him. So I think it's a lot of it has to do with the politics of it, that Truman and Eisenhower cement Marshall as this extraordinary figure. And people read back into it into the Second World War, whereas he's not dominant in the Second World War. He is very important as Truman's, when it comes to what happens in China, probably disastrously, that's Marshall. When the start of the Cold War, he's very important for the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. In fact, he beats Leahy. But when Truman's president, basically Leahy and Marshall fight quite a lot, but in those cases, Marshall wins. He wins about China. He wins about, Leahy doesn't want to actually support Greece or Turkey. He wants a very restrained Cold War. He said, stay out of the Middle East. This is all Marshall pushing it. So Marshall wins under Truman. He loses under Roosevelt, but Truman comes later, and therefore you remember that.
It is amazing, though, how there are these moments in the narrative of World War II where things just get, everything that we think we knew gets turned on its head. I mean, we've just been having big discussions yesterday about this kind of sort of declinist view of the Western Allies, and particularly Britain, that, the army was rubbish, that Germans were better and all this kind of stuff. And, it's sort of maddening that this stuff still has some kind of traction. What you're saying about Leahy is just, I mean, I'm just absolutely...
It's incredible. It's mind-boggling.
It's fascinating. I mean, it's really, really interesting. And I find your whole thesis on the war, and I mean, one of the reasons why I was so keen to get you on is because I'm such a fan. I think your book is completely brilliant. It's fascinating. Any book that kind of shakes it up and makes you kind of go... Hang on a minute, I've been looking at this slightly the wrong way around. For me, that's terrific. When I kind of read the same boring old shit that I've read 100 times before, I kind of sort of, what's the point?
You know why, James? Because I think there's an unhealthy love of the German army by many people who don't want to admit it.
Yes, I would agree.
So much of our vision of the Second World War by sort of Second World War historians and people who talk about it is driven by... a love of the German army, though they would never call it love. It's a huge respect. As if there's this fabulous fighting corps who can take on the world with these great-looking tanks and these amazing machine guns. And that the Western Allies are sort of boring because they have air cover and they don't have to die.
It's cheating.
It's cheating. If I were a British and American, I wouldn't want to die. And I probably wouldn't die. So as a British or an American soldier, why take the risk? I mean, I have to say, there's a fundamental, the American and British are fighting a modern war. And in a modern war, you limit casualties. You don't have to do incredibly stupid things because you should have air cover and modern artillery.
I'm Anthony. Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
The British in the Second World War do not execute a single person for desertion. You know, the Germans conservatively have killed 30,000, you know, conservatively. You know, it is amazing that they managed to do what they do without that kind of stick and threat and all the rest.
Well, they don't have those levers at their disposal, and the Russians do, and the Soviets do, and you look at the profligate loss of life. It doesn't work or anything, does it? It doesn't help. I mean, it is really interesting because in your book you talk about the Battle of the Bulge, and you say that, you know, that it's a 20-mile advance, and Piper's lauded as this sort of brilliant tank commander. There's no air cover. They're literally relying on bad weather.
It's primitive.
So that they can fight in 1D rather than the 3D they've been, you know, because if you leave the sea battle out, because the sea battle sort of arguably incidental, although actually it isn't, because the sea battle's been won, which is why the Americans have the kit they can to rush up and plug gaps and all that sort of thing, although, as you said earlier, they're short of people. But you know, they're literally relying on bad weather to try and advance 20 miles.
And this, I mean, the Battle of the Bulge is a typical example of battle-centric understanding of the war not mattering in victory or defeat, but mattering as a story. The Battle of the Bulge is an extraordinary story. You know, this huge land battle, lots of narratives, you know, lots of major personalities, people dying. The amazing thing about it, of course, it's an unwinnable battle, but people only write about the time when the weather's bad. If you read any history of the Battle of the Bulge, it's basically December 16th to December 25th. Oh, yeah, the sky is clear on the 25th. It's over. Yeah. And then, well, actually, the battle goes, the Americans don't get back to the German lines until well into January. But no one writes about the longer time of the longest time of the battle with the most casualties is the period from December 25th onwards. Yeah, but no, that's boring because they have
Where they're winkling them out.
They're going to win, and the Germans are just holding on. Yeah. So basically, it's the typical example of writing about, you know, the drama, but the drama's the fake drama.
Well, and also, but also the drama is, I mean, we earlier on when we talked about large Navy, Raider being a big battleship guide, that is all part of Nazi PR drama as a way of selling things politically. And that once Blitzkrieg is coined as a thing, and once you've had the Battle of France, you're into this idea of decisive moment drama battle, Sturm und Drang, basically German Nazi conceptions of what war is and what war delivers you and all that sort of thing, which is the sort of the seductive end of how the war was presented at the time. Even, you know, that you end up the Allies end up thinking, oh golly, the German army's brilliant at everything it does, and they end up thinking, and obviously that if you're a soldier on the sharp end of dealing with Germans who won't give up positions and all that sort of thing, because that's what it comes down to in the land battles is diehards in Japan and in Germany who won't give an inch. But as you point out as well in your book, the front line in Germany where is the front line in 1945 in Germany? It's the whole of the country. Absolutely. The whole country.
Every city is in the front line.
Yeah.
And the Battle of the Bulge is a classic one, by the way. Probably the worst film of the Second World War. About the Second World War is the better.
But you've seen Escape to Victory.
It's built on this notion of a sort of fetishization of the German army. You know, Shaw. Yep. Playing, you know, this bleach blonde Hessler and his dashing black with the most amazing tanks that simply crush everything and forth. I mean, it's built on this notion of this amazing thing that is the German army. And by the way, so it seems to be fighting in Northern California. If you look at the terrain, makes no sense.
It's Spain, I think they made the film. Is it Spain?
Yeah. So the big open fields. And if they actually, and they run out of fuel, if they ever fought in big open fields, Allied air power, with under blue skies, Allied air power would have just destroyed them instantly, and that would have been, you know, without any drama whatsoever.
Yeah.
But it's one of those where we get this fetishization of the Germans.
Listen, before you go, I've got to ask you about, you were due to be coming to the Chalk Valley History Festival, sadly no more this year, but hopefully coming back strong in 2021. But you were due to come down and do a little thing about the Battle of Britain, and you've got an amazing theory about this, which I really like, which is this idea that, so part of the narrative myth, of course, is that the RAF were massively outnumbered. I mean, obviously, if you kind of sort of put the entire Luftwaffe against Fighter Command, obviously that figure does look a little bit outnumbered. But your point is that there's another metric by which to judge combat efficiency over the battle space.
We look at, you know, when we sometimes even just adding number, you know, but we add numbers, does that matter? I have 1,000 aircraft, you have 800 aircraft, you know, I'm larger, you know, stronger. But of course, what matters in the Battle of Britain is for how long can you effectively fly in the combat area. The combat area is southern England. And when we're talking, I mean, basically from, you know, a little bit over the coast of southern England up to London and a little bit farther, that's where most of the combat actually is. And if you're dealing with the fact that the Germans have a few more fighters, by the way, not nearly as many fighters as Churchill thought, when Churchill gives that famous speech, he's not lying. He actually thinks the Germans drastically outnumber the British. They just don't happen to.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He's making it based on faulty intelligence. From what we know, the Germans have a few hundred more fighters. Right? So you might say numerically they have a few more. However, the Germans, the ME-109 and the Spitfire are about as evenly classed aircrafts as you have in the Second World War. No aircraft are exactly the same, but they're relatively close in what they can do. So you might think one ME-109 should approximately equal one Spitfire. But if my Spitfire takes off, you know, only 20 yards from where the combat's going to occur, and the ME-109 takes off 120 miles from where that combat is going to occur, that ME-109 can only engage in combat for a few minutes before it has to turn around and go back. Whereas my Spitfire can engage in six times as much operations. So by the combat multiplier of where they're fighting, each Spitfire is probably worth 4 to 5 ME-109s. Because it can keep flying. It can keep flying for that long. Yeah, and therefore, by that, if you add up not the numbers of aircraft, but say the minutes that the aircraft can fly in combat operations, the British can fly many more minutes, many times minutes. And that, you would say, would actually, so the Battle of Britain, the British have greater effective air power over the area of battle than the Germans.
But that's right there in the accounts, because the Germans will say, you know, we met up with the bombers, we were lucky. You know, we had to turn back. We only had, and the British, like, well, I got redirected to somewhere else. We went up, we had a look for some people, and then we got directed. You know, that they've got this, like you say, this luxury of time and therefore several encounters per sortie.
It's partly that the British don't want to undermine the few.
No, myth. Of course not.
Yeah, because that's become ingrained so much. But actually, the underway to understand the Battle of Britain is the superior air and sea power and won it very easily. Battle of Britain is without drama.
I agree with that entirely. Well, there's still plenty of drama. But I mean, it's interesting, Phil, because, you know, if you look at Battle of Britain Day, for example, you know, the biggest engagement of the day peaks around kind of 3:30 in the afternoon in southeast London. At that time, there are 300 German aircraft that have been sent over, of which 100 are bombers and 200 are fighters. Opposing them are 335 Spitfires and Hurricanes. Now, obviously, if you are one of 12 and you're attacking 300, you feel quite outnumbered. But, you know, it is the job of the historian to kind of take a step back and look at it kind of a bit more objectively. And, you know, that is just a fact. It's there's no debate about that. There's no dispute about it. That is how many aircraft were involved. And, of course, 335 is not even half what Fighter Command has at that particular point.
No, Fighter Command is a far more powerful force than the Luftwaffe Fighter Command. I mean, what they can send over. So that's the thing about the Battle of Britain. Basically, the Germans are the few and the British are the many.
Hold steady on.
No, really. When it comes to, and you know, that doesn't even take into account.
No, we can just hear that clipped out of context, though.
The Royal Navy. Those who understood strategic policy, like Morris Hanke, said, "Oh, we would love the Germans to try to invade."
Yeah.
It would have been great for us if the Germans had tried to invade, because it would have been such a catastrophe had they tried any kind of landing in southern England. I mean, it probably wouldn't even have gotten out of the French ports, to be perfectly honest, and everyone would have been sunk on the way over. But you know, it's just Britain is a superior air and sea power in 1941. And it works itself out in the battle, and works itself out quite quickly. It's just the fall of France had just, I think the fall of France had created quite a cosmic shock, where the Luftwaffe played to its real strengths, which was as a tactical force.
Yeah, close air support, isn't it?
Yeah. So it did close air support very effectively. And then people just sort of said, oh my God, the Luftwaffe can do everything. And it must be so large, because the French collapsed in the way they did. But that wasn't true.
Well, the people primarily responsible for believing that was the German high command. The very first people to take that, drink that particular Kool-Aid was the Germans. And you know, more than anybody else. We come back to that idea that the shock of that victory in France still holds people in its sort of psychic grasp, doesn't it? Which is where I think, I mean, I'd say, you know, that the heart, I actually think, is a hard on people have for the German forces. Yeah. So we have talked about how battles make no difference, but if there's one battle that has cast such a massive shadow, it's the fall of France, isn't it?
It is actually the one, I would say, flaw in the non-battle centric view of the war.
Yeah.
Because presumably the Battle of France is the only battle that could have gone either way. Maybe. You had the French deployed everything differently. No other battle in the Second World War could have gone any other way. I really don't know. There's no drama in any other Second World War battle. Battle of Britain's going to go the certain way. The invasion of the Soviet Union of 41 is going to go the certain way. You know, what happens in every battle is basically predetermined. The only battle, I would argue, it's not predetermined is the Battle of France of 1940.
Which is why it's still such an amazing period of just such astonishing drama. And I'm sure that you're absolutely right that the Battle of Britain myth comes out of the fact that for this brief moment, you know, they are rabbits in headlights. The British, and obviously the French as well, you know, they're just so shocked by what's happened that it takes them a while to kind of regain their balance and think, actually, hang on a minute. And suddenly from being kind of quite confident, they are kind of underdogs and they've lost sight of actually what their strength is, which is air and naval power. Even if the BEF had been completely destroyed in France, that is no reason for throwing in the towel. And yet it very probably would have led to that.
But then we're in the political realm, and things that are politically unsustainable are different. You know, are different to strategically sustainable, aren't they?
Dunkirk makes no difference in terms of whether Britain would have won or lost. It makes a difference politically whether they stay in the war.
Yeah.
The idea that taking those soldiers off the beaches in Dunkirk, Britain is still uninvadable with or without Dunkirk.
Yeah.
You know, the German invasion still wouldn't work. It just politically meant Britain might have asked for peace. But I don't even think it would have. I really don't think that they would have asked for peace. And I don't think Churchill could have in 1940. Sorry. But
Well,
that's been great. Thank you, Phil.
It's sensational. Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been enjoyable.
Ah, God. Yeah.
Well, I have to come on again. I mean, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to talk about, as ever. And we didn't digress too heavily.
No, but I mean, I just want to thank you, Phil, for kind of, you know, your book has really, it's been one of those handful of books over the last sort of 10, 15 years that I've read where I've really thought, wow, okay, this is a different way of looking at things. So
it certainly has caused some controversy, but I do get angry emails all the time for destroying the memory of Soviet dead or stuff like that. So.
Oh, well.
Yeah, but, you know, the job of the historian is to try and...
Yeah. It's to take angry emails. Yeah, that's
the job. Yeah.
You guys must get lots of them, actually.
Oh yeah, you fair few.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thanks ever so much. That's been a really, really fascinating hour, or two lots of half hour, I should say. Thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Cheerio.